Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Well, I see that our host is temporarily... Oh, there he is. He's back. Hi, Kevin. I was just going to make the announcement.
I'm now undisclosed.
There you go.
I'm disclosed now.
There you go.
I'm fully dressed. Let's just be careful.
I was just
going to
say,
whatever
you have pajama bottoms on or what? Come on.
Hey, I'm wearing the painter pants. I'm good to go.
There you
any
go.
Occasion. Good morning, all. Good morning, Brieflies. Good morning, Vachon. Welcome to February.
On the radio.
You're on the radio, Bruce Hallman. Glad you could join us. Yeah. Let's see. Today has some special significance in a couple of different ways. And we will call on Lynn Kerrigan, our Celtic expert, to discuss what Imbolc is, and am I even pronouncing it correctly? Lynn, what can you tell us about Imbolc, and how do you pronounce it correctly?
I think that's close enough for us who aren't schooled in the language, and I'm a little schooled in Scots Gaelic, but not so much that I would be considered fluent or an expert, but thank you. I don't know, I was trying to get my mic on, so I didn't hear you mention the Lunar New Year. You know, it's also Tet, the Asian Lunar New Year.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
indeed it is.
Yes, I think that tribes and cultures all over the world had celebrations to announce the beginning of spring. And Imbolc is this period of time halfway between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. So it is a celebration of the return of the light and of the sprouts of the earth and of the era of the hearth. And it celebrates Brigia. Some say Bridget, some say Brigid. The Celtic sort of goddess of the hearth, because this is the time when women are inside and they're preparing the food and they are preparing the clothing, and the hearth is where you want to be in the winter. And I'll just say real quickly something that I was looking up in some of my Celtic books. In Old Scotland, February the 1st fell in the middle of the period known as the Fealdach, the wolf month. It was also known as Marvios, the dead month. But although the season was so cold and drear, we knew to start looking for the signs of new life. Lambs are born, and rain brings new grass, and ravens build their nests, and larks are said to sing with a clearer voice. And the Cailleach, the old woman of winter, was transformed into Brigia, the fair woman of February, who's fragile and yet growing stronger each day as the sun rekindles its fire. And maybe at the end of the show, I'll read a poem that honors St. Bridget.
All right. Fantastic, Lynn. Thank you for that overview. And, we will note that celestial spring, according to astronomers, starts on March 20th. So I think this just shows the Celts are definitely ahead of their time.
That's right. Any excuse for a party.
Now the truth comes out.
You betcha. What do you think we drank at those hearthsides?
Yeah, you bet.
Well, there are actually eight altogether. We mark the equinoxes, the solstices, winter, summer solstice, the equinoxes in the spring and in the fall. But Celtic cultures, among others, also recognize these in-between seasons. So they actually would count almost eight seasons.
Yes.
And Halloween falls on one of those.
Mm-hmm. Samhain. It's pronounced, it looks like Samhain in English, and it's pronounced Samhain.
Right. That's right. May 1st is another one.
Mm-hmm. Beltane.
And then there's one, I believe,
Lunasa. Lunasa, which is the celebration of all things dark and glorious.
Yeah, so it's lovely that some of these traditions remain alive even today. I love that. I know, you know, a lot of Christian culture spread across the world and plopped itself right down on top of these other holidays. You know, winter solstice, of course, falls right next to Christmas, and Easter on the equinox, and you see this regularly just as they built. And maybe Bruce would like to comment on this. Very common in olden times that churches were erected on the sites of pagan worship areas or pagan sacred areas. So we did it with dates as well as places. So it's wonderful that those remain. Yeah, Lynn.
One last comment I will make is that one of the things I love about the Celtic calendar and the Celtic culture is that they had very strong laws protecting and honoring women. Women had much more equality under the law, under Brian law, than under Roman law. And so one of the things I like about the Celtic culture is that they really celebrate some of the aspects of women that are often left out of the Christian calendars. So there's some balance between light and dark, male and female, the kind of coming of the light and the going of the light. It's a little bit of a balanced culture that I really respect, and very tied to the earth, to trees, to nature, to the symbology and the realities of the turning of the seasons.
Mm-hmm. And some of those things we'll hear more about on the show today. And so brought to you from the clan here at the Briefly Clan at Voice of Vashon, our Irish heritage is showing. Hey, the other thing happening today, for those who didn't know, it's National Serpent Day. And you know, there's some people are overjoyed at Serpent Day, and some people are have a different opinion. So let's do a check-in. Let's go around, sort of around the Briefly world here, and check in either your fun facts about snakes, your disregard for snakes, or just what else is going on in your world. Maybe Bruce, you can kick off.
Sure,
how's it going?
I think Truman will agree with me. It always amazes me when I run into people who grew up in the Pacific Northwest, west of the mountains. They step over logs without looking. They reach their hands in every time.
They do.
Thinking about it. Yep. You know, if you grew up around snakes, particularly poisonous snakes, you know, I grew up in the South, you know, Truman grew up in Texas. You just didn't do those things.
Sure,
you
know,
you stomp the ground first. You hit the wood pile.
That's
first.
Right.
You sort of look at where you put your hand.
You bet you do.
Pacific Northwesterners, you grew up in too much of a protected environment, I think.
Yeah. It's like they say about Australia, everything there's trying to kill you. Well, it's kind of the same in itself.
Exactly.
That's right.
All right. So other than snake lore, Truman, how's it going on your end?
Well, good. I have a couple of things. On the snakes, though, I have to tell you that growing up as a kid, the last thing that my mother said to me as I walked out the door, every time I walked the door, watch out for snakes. Every time. Without fail. I mean, without fail. So I have a real appreciation for that. But hey, today, the first is Freedom Day. It was the day that Lincoln signed the what would become the 13th Amendment. That's also today, which is the beginning of Black History Month. So our show this morning, we had all black artists, and we probably will continue that all month because there's some amazing talent in the music world. But there you go.
Wow.
Absolutely. Gail, what are your thoughts?
You know, being a native Northwesterner, I was raised here, and absolutely only later did I come to appreciate how much, you know, we don't have really poisonous spiders, snakes. There's really nothing that's going to hurt you in the Northwest. Not even mosquitoes, really, is hard to speak of. So we have it so easy. And
you have to remember Sasquatch is out there.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. That's right. Well, they had to make up something.
As a child, oh, I looked for them. I looked for them when we were out camping and hiking. Yeah, just wanted to see that. But my grandmother, when, you know, I was in the same house where I am now here on the hill here overlooking the sea, there were garter snakes, and there still are. And she would pay us 5 cents for the little ones and 10 cents for the big ones if we would catch them. And, you know, I don't know why she didn't like them. They're really actually wonderful for your yard. They eat the slugs and things like that if you're a gardener. But she didn't care for them. So, of course, all we did was transport them down to the neighbor's yard a few feet away down the boardwalk. So, you know, so it makes me laugh now. But my favorite recent snake story was that I last summer, I have a nice warm cement walkway where I occasionally see snakes in this, and they're just garter snakes, you know, so they're not dangerous at all. They look like any other snake though, so they're a little scary to look at sometimes if you're at all squeamish about them. But this one was the largest one I'd ever seen, and I don't know if it was very old or had just eaten, but it didn't skitter away like they often do when they see you coming. And so I sat and watched it, just kind of sat down next to it for a long time, and I actually reached out and just petted it, and it did not scoot away. Was gone I went back and checked another half hour, 45 minutes later, and it was gone. But it was absolutely peaceful, just having a nap in the sun. So that was kind of that's my snake story for today.
Yeah. Dances with snakes. Lynn, you may not have ever had that kind of an experience with a snake, as Gail describes.
Oh, I've had experiences with snakes. I'm sitting here sweating all over. Yeah. Because I'm
No snake petting.
I'm like, okay, Bruce. I grew up, you know, in the South where swimming alongside water moccasins. And I'll tell you, the thing that rushes to my forebrain, it's probably my lowest brain, you know, my reptilian brain, if you were.
So to speak, yeah.
I was a camp counselor for the Girl Scouts in Camp Gazelle Dew outside of Rome, Georgia, when I was, I think, just finished my freshman year in college. And it was a 6-week program. We had to be there the first week ahead of time to clean out the lake. And that meant going out in the lake with a canoe and pitchforks, because it was all manner of milfoil and disgusting thing in this tiny little lake. And we hauled out forks full of snakes that would fall off the pitchfork into the canoe. No matter what we did, we had to clear that lake, because that's where the kids were going to have to swim. Oh, and so it was sort of like, you know, the behavioral technique they call flooding, which means if you're phobic about something, you just put yourself in an environment where there's a million of whatever it is. There's really only so panicked you can get. So at the time, I just dug in and dug out those snakes. But I have burst into a sweat every other time around snakes. So it's delayed post-traumatic snake disorder.
Well, after today, it's a whole nother year before National Serpent Day, so you've got some relief. I do have to comment on the Western Washington thing. For many years, I was involved with the Mountaineers Scrambling Course, which is unaided climbing of mountain peaks. So you're not having the ropes and all the stuff in the harness. You're out there on your own, you know, grabbing for handholds and footholds. And the rock training episode was in Eastern Washington, just outside of Leavenworth, up Icicle Creek. Mm-hmm. And all of the Western Washingtonians who signed up for the course were given this very stern warning about rattlesnakes. And you should be very cautious, and the whole thing that you just described, Bruce and Truman. And it was, if you see a rattlesnake, you need to back away and, you know, quickly choose a different route. So I was leading a group. And indeed, the first and last rattlesnake I've ever seen in my life was on the route that we had chosen to climb up this rock face. And I saw it pretty early on from a distance and said, "Hey, everybody, rattlesnake, we need to back away." And one of the group leaders said, "Rattlesnake, where?" And she runs up with her camera to take a close-up picture just to proof that they're there. So I thought, okay, well, you know, if you know what you're doing, I guess you can get away with that. So, yeah, be cautious.
Kevin, what inspired you about this snake day, please? Because I want to be more worn next time.
Okay. Well, I will. So what do they call that when you do that? Just a trigger warning or something like that? There's a website that's basically what every day of the year is. And I can probably find it here. But, I just figured that there is a dayforthat.com website. So if you're ever wondering about what day today is in history, go to the website. There's a dayforthat.com and check out what's coming up. So that's where I found that.
It's disgusting.
Well, I think if I can jump in, I think, and Truman, you've probably had this experience as well, and maybe Lynn, but I mean, one of the scariest things in the world is to be walking along a trail and to hear a rattlesnake and not know where it is.
Yeah.
That's
right. You freeze mm-hmm. and you sort of start looking around. You try and figure out where's that sound coming from. And then you move as quick as you can out of there once you know about where it is, because you don't want to move toward it. But that is a strange, strange feeling to just hear that rattle.
Or riding your horse and have your horse step over it, and then the horse goes straight up.
Bolts.
And you think, man, I got to stay on this horse because I don't want to get down there with him.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Okay, be fair warned and fair armed. Yeah. Okay, hey, so let's see. The other thing with local Vashon aviation news, and actually Gail brought this up for discussion last week, but we didn't get to it. You know, the 5G cell phone rollout is making aviation news over the possible interference with commercial airline altimeters, which says how high above the ground the airplane is. Will this affect us on Vashon? Do we need to close our airport? Should our listeners book your flights now, before it's too late? Why don't we check in with our captain of the airways and solar panel enthusiast, our pilot, Truman O'Brien?
Okay.
Truman, what can you tell us about this?
I don't think you have to worry about that here on Vashon.
Because
what 5G, what they're worried about is it's affecting radar altimeters. Now, there are two types of altimetry that we use. One is a barometric altimeter, and that is basically just a barometer. It measures the difference in air pressure. And we use that, there's a method of setting that so that it will read your height above sea level, not above the ground. When airliners or larger commercial aircraft are landing at an airport with a specific kind of approach, they have also what's known as a radar altimeter. And this one is an altimeter that bounces a radio signal off of the ground. It measures the time it takes for it to get to the ground and back to the airplane. And that gives you your height above the ground. And those are only used for about the last 500 feet above the ground. And that does tell you your height above the ground. And some of our instrument approaches, which we use in bad weather, are predicated on that radar altimeter. Now, a normal visual day, or a day where you don't have low clouds and fog, that's not a factor because you don't really use it at all. Where you do use it, though, is if you have reduced visibility. So, for example, we have a number of classification of approaches that you would use to a runway. They're known as category 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and 3. And then there are subcategories of those, but we call them Cat 1, Cat 2, Cat 3. If you're shooting a Cat 3 approach, that's one where your decision height, the altitude that you decide that you're whether or not you're going to land, you have to be able to see the ground. That on a Cat 3 approach, that can be 100 feet or it can be no feet. In other words, when you get down to the ones that I used to shoot were Cat 3B, and that was a 50-foot radar altimeter. When you were at 50 feet, you had to be able to see one runway light. If you didn't see a runway light, you missed the approach. Mm-hmm. In other words, you added power and you went around. But today, with the heads-up display and with the autoland systems that we have, Alaska Airlines right now has a minimum height of 30 feet and a visibility of 400 feet. I mean, it's called runway visual range. There's a machine that measures that density of the fog. And if you can see 400 feet or more, you can land. And I can tell you that 400 feet is not very far. I've taken off, our takeoff minimums were 300 feet. I think I mentioned that last time. And at 300 feet, you can see maybe one light on the one runway light, centerline light. And that's it.
You're coming in at how fast?
A couple hundred miles an hour, roughly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I need to say one more thing. With Cat 3 approaches, those have to be auto land. The autopilot actually lands the airplane. It has to be coupled, and you have two autopilots that are talking to each other, and you have that in combination with the heads up display. So you're seeing what's happening through the window, but the airplane is actually flying itself on two autopilots. And it actually flares, reduces the power. It does everything and lands the airplane. And then you take over after the touchdown. But you have
to. So our listeners should be thinking about the idea of driving at 150 miles an hour when you can see 400 feet ahead of you in the fog.
That's correct.
For one thing.
Yeah.
Thanks for that tutorial in aviation technology and aviation safety. And I'm curious what the briefly is. Any other thoughts about this whole 5G altimeter thing? Gail, and then Lynn.
Just to follow up, Truman. So what is the 5G concern that it's going to interfere with that second form, the second form of
radar altimeter?
Checking what do you call it again?
Radar altimeter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it would interfere with that?
That's correct. Yeah.
And in your estimation, will it interfere? Could it interfere with that?
I've been reading a fair amount and they weren't sure for a long time. The frequencies are fairly close together that they're using. And so far it looks like it's not going to be a factor, but they're still not, you know, absolutely sure. So they have to go out and do a bunch of flight tests to make sure that it is indeed reading accurately. So it, since the airplane is using that radar altimeter to determine when to flare, I mean, it's the airplane's making the decision. It's pretty darned important that that radar altimeter is accurate and it's not being thrown off. So I don't know what the answer is yet.
Okay. Lynn, did you have a comment?
I have a quick comment and a question for Truman. So my quick comment is, I want to be a 4G island in a 5G world. Second, I want to understand why the airplane and the telecommunications people did not talk about this earlier.
Well, there are two different agencies. You have the FCC and you have the FAA. And I think Bruce can probably talk to that various government agencies rarely talk to each other about anything. I don't care what it is. And I think that's probably one of the reasons. I'm sure the FCC just didn't realize that the radar altimeters were on that frequency. I don't know. That'd be my guess.
Okay, and Bruce, you're on mute right now.
Part of it's turf wars, but also a big part of this particular one is sort of the destabilization of agencies under the last administration.
Yeah,
you know, many of these agencies didn't have appointed heads. You sort of had the deep state was working it. But, you know, and that's why we have the deep state, you know, that's why we have schools and planes and buses and things running on time. But, you know, the people at the top were not really focused on it because there weren't people at the top who had been appointed to a lot of these agencies. And you know, that's the problem. One of the problems with the concept of trying to minimize government, when government has certain very important functions that shouldn't be minimized. So it's part of that philosophical this debate that we're seeing going on between Republicans and Democrats that are going to sort of affect the future of the United States in the next 20, 30 years. We're going to have more and more of these.
Oh, yeah, Bruce, you just froze.
Sorry.
But I can throw one more thing out there. One thing that I've been thinking about, we keep talking about voting and voting rights and curtail ability to vote. And it makes me wonder, you know, the states certainly should have control over the voting within the state. But I'm wondering if federal elections shouldn't be federally regulated.
You know, rather, overseen.
Yeah. I mean, why are states, I mean, Bruce, you can probably address this, but I mean, it doesn't make sense to me that states have a jurisdiction over a federal election. You know, what, I don't get that.
Yeah. And technically they don't, you know, the Constitution gives the power of the states to run elections in congressional elections, but gives Congress the power to control those. You know, so, you know, and that's where the debate comes from. And that's where, when you bring in the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments and this concept of citizenship, it's sort of that sense of why the Civil War was fought. It was over the power of the federal government to control state governments and control how states deal with citizens. And we've got a long way to go, have a long, bitter history of that. But essentially, you know, I would find it unimaginable that the courts would not find, as it works through the courts, that essentially the Constitution trumps, if you will, states' rights in these kind of things.
I think we need to come up with a new term.
Yeah, for overriding.
Change bridge.
Yeah,
thank you. Need to change the game of bridge.
Yeah, there you go.
Isn't that true? Yes. So I think, Truman, interesting question. You know, there's some security in the states and the distributed system, right, that is in place right now in terms of, you know, hacking, cybersecurity, things like that. And I think that the objective of the progressives in the federal government is to at least create some standards that are federally applied. But Lynn, I didn't know if you had a comment to make there.
Well, it was reminding me that I had a correction to last week, to something I said last week, Bruce, when you were talking about, you know, how the current political status is sort of affected by all of this in terms of our voting rights and who controls it and everything. And just reminds me that I misspoke about the term sedition last week. I went home and looked it up, and the sedition that you see our House Investigating Committee circling around with, it means the conspiracy among individuals to overthrow the government through insurrection. So we've been dealing with insurrection, you know, the acts of individuals to incite violence about the election and the electoral process. And I'm just correcting that sedition is the collaboration and the planning and the coordination and the intent between all of these people in advance to overthrow the government. So that's what's happening in the House now. They're laying groundwork for sedition, not just insurrection. So it just reminded me of that. Thanks, Bruce.
Well, and there's a long history of sedition in the United States being problematic. The Alien Sedition Acts of the late 1700s were used as a political weapon to silence political opponents. And so sedition has barely seldom been used in the United States. Because one, it's difficult to prove, you know, intent, and also it becomes a limit on free speech, and it becomes a limit on political activity of opponents of who's in power. So it's a slippery slope, to say the best.
Well, that does kind of bring us to federal issues, and I want to kick off this next topic about called in my mind the SCOTUS with the mostest. And so Justice Breyer, of course, we've all heard, has now announced his retirement, and it has progressives buzzing. And the Biden announcement to nominate a Black woman to the court has conservatives frothing. So is this all affirmative action, or is it, it's darn well about time? Gail or Lynn, would you care to start us off on this part of the discussion?
Well, I love seeing the diversity in our country being reflected by our lawmaking institutions. That's, I think, the first thing that I'll say. And sure, and why not, you know, kind of correct 400 years of mistreatment and misrepresentation. So I am pleased by it, and I think that it's about time we had somebody really standing up and representing the other perspectives in this country. I know that Clarence Thomas has been an African-American member of the court for many years, and I thought it was interesting on the news to say that they felt like the election of Biden had a lot to do with black females organizing and really the example of black Americans coming together, like Stacey Abrams, to make the Fair Fight organizations that are challenging the suppression of votes. So for me, it's a joyous occasion.
Yeah, I will just double down on that. To me, it's definitely, as you put it well, Kevin, about time. We have had in the course of history how many dozens, if not over 100, Supreme Court members that are white males. We have had only, I believe, if I add them up, four women that have been elected or have been appointed to the Supreme Court. So it's just so incredibly lopsided. And it's one of the things when we can't really say that we are representing, that everyone's represented, if we don't have some kind of equal representation in such an important body as the Supreme Court. You know, women's perspectives are just by the nature of our experience going to be different than men's, just as minorities' experiences are, you know, people of color's experience is going to be different than people that are white. And so I think it's very, very important that this begins to be reflected in such an important body as the Supreme Court.
You know, yes. Here's my two cents. I completely agree with the thought of putting a black woman on. I mean, I think that's absolutely fine. But at the same time, the Supreme Court, none of that should matter. I mean, if you really, really get down to it, it should not matter what your background is. It should not matter what ethnicity you are or what sex you are. The law is the law. And it should, and of course, we all know that that's not the case, but it should not matter what your background is. Of course, we know it is, but.
That's so great. Thanks for saying that, Truman, because yeah, I mean, justice is blind, right?
That whole
idea that shouldn't matter. You know, it's been an interesting, I don't know if any of you follow AI news, artificial intelligence news, but one thought that futurists talk about is turning over much of our justice system, though it would still be overseen by humans, but much of the system would be adjudicated by AI because it would be blind. That's one of the cases people make for using AI as, you know, taking the human factor out of it that is by its very nature biased.
Of course.
Yeah, that's a whole can of worms. So
I was going to say, of course, that, you know, the humanity is what makes the whole thing work. You know, really, if you think about it.
But you know, it's to your point. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, no, I agree.
We want that on one hand, and we don't want it on
exactly,
one hand.
We're exactly.
We're conflicted, I think, as a country and as a human.
I agree.
Yeah, Bruce, your thoughts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what's interesting, I mean, in all the history of the Supreme Court, there's only been four women. There's only been two black men, you know, Thurgood Marshall and Clarence Thomas. It couldn't be more different philosophically. But, you know, again, it's that sense of, you know, should the institutions of a country reflect the people of the country? And that's really the question. And Truman's right, you know, in a perfect world, you know, and if there were a perfect meritocracy, then you'd have the best people in the best places. You know, 45 indicated to me that that's not always the case. So,
I have to comment on that. I have to comment that about halfway through his administration, you know, I was just pulling my hair out, screaming like, "What in the heck have we done?" And a good friend of mine who's a big Trump supporter said, "Well, look," he said, "I know the guy's a jerk, but," and that wasn't the term he used, but he said, "But do you want if you're going to go in and have surgery, do you want the best surgeon or do you want a surgeon that's a good guy?" Well, I think we blew it on both counts with Trump. I mean, I don't think he was the best guy or the good guy. You know what I mean? Oh, geez.
I hear you. Hey, yeah, go ahead, Lynn.
I was just going to say, I kind of think about this from a little bit of a backwards perspective, Truman, because I think all through history, you know, the laws have been based on might makes right. You know, when we were more tribal and hunting societies and gathering societies, and every decision was relative and every decision was made by the, you know, the people who could make the laws. And I think that the great thing about, you know, English and American law has been, you know, the standing up, the organizing of the common people to say, no, you know, should there not be laws that are fairly applied, and should we not codify these laws so that everything is not just made up on the spur of the moment based on the immediate circumstances? And so, you know, the nobles made King John sign the Magna Carta. Mm-hmm. And we've been going on from there trying to figure out, how do we find a principle? How do we take a principle?
But that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yes, it is. Yeah. But I'm coming at it from the other side.
Okay, yeah.
Saying that I don't see the law coming first,
right,
and then
we
blow it. I see people come first, and then we blow it.
We make the laws that, and then we screw it up. Yeah,
well,
okay.
And then we try to correct
through
the legislative process about what could be fair, you know, to people.
Okay.
Yeah, Gail, your thoughts.
I just like to imagine, had the framers of the Constitution been just a little bit more evolved, and women
and female.
Now wait a minute. Let's take it easier with this evolution thing.
Breathe, okay. Truman. Just breathe.
How, I wonder what our country would look like now, 250 years later, had women always been fairly represented, had minorities always been represented in and protected by our laws and given those equal rights. I mean, it'll probably take us still another 250 years if we're lucky to still be around to find that out, you know, but because we're not even there. We're arguing over putting a fifth woman and a third Black person on, and someone feels righteous enough to say that we shouldn't do that. And it seems remarkable to me.
Bruce, I also want to hear Bruce's opinion on New Zealand with that. You're muted, Bruce. You're muted.
Yeah. Sorry, I've got my grandson here who's running around. So, yeah, Australia wrote their constitution in 1901, and they enshrined women's rights in their constitution. And it hasn't been radically different than the United States. So I'm not sure that the framers of our Constitution would have done any better. You know, I mean, it's that's an example of, you know, a Constitution written 100 years later that includes women's rights. And Australia certainly has some democratic advantages over the United States, but women's rights are not particularly advanced, more advanced in Australia than they are here, although they're constitutionally protected.
All right. Well, I would like to move us on. We have one more really important topic before we close the show in just another 6 minutes. But my last thoughts about the SCOTUS with the mostest is that I did hear one commentary about that Black women only comprise 6% of the population of the country. So having an entire Supreme Court justice position by sitting, you know, by a Black woman on the court just seems like it's too much. And that sort of implies that zero is okay. And so, I don't buy that. The other thing is, I've done a fair amount of policy work in the last 3 or 4 years. And the thing that's challenging about policy work, either laws or regulations, is the interpretation of the written word and the care that goes into how to write the written word in a way that doesn't create opportunities for misinterpretation or loopholes or escape clauses and things like that. And I equate that to the fact that we have also a very healthy legal system and a judicial system in the country, where interpretation becomes so much an important aspect of how laws are applied in the country. And so while justice is blind, is interpretation suffer as a consequence of blind justice? But we could talk more about this topic, but why don't we go on to the fact that, Truman, you mentioned earlier, it is the start of Black History Month. And there are so many stories to be told. And I really appreciate the fact that you want to continue that theme throughout the month. I would say, Bruce, what can you tell us about the history of Black History Month, and then invite folks to share any moments in Black history that they'd like to share with our listeners in a few minutes we have left?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating history. It began with a historian, Carter G. Woodson, who was earned a PhD from Harvard, and then 1915 founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life. And it's that organization that in 1926 sponsored the first Black History Week, or Negro History Week, as it was called at that time. What's fascinating about Carter G. Woodson is he earned his PhD at Harvard. He taught at Howard University, and that's where sort of the impulse of Black, of what becomes Black History Month originates. But what's fascinating to me about Carter Woodson is he's the only person in the United, only Black person in the United States to earn a PhD whose parents were enslaved.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So an interesting kind of journey for him. But in 1926, the first Negro History Week was sponsored. And then as a result of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the first Black History Month was celebrated at Kent State University in 1970. And then in 1976, on the bicentennial of the United States, President Gerald Ford declared February to be Black History Month, and every president since has designated February as Black History Month. So it goes back to Carter G. Woodson, it goes back to his parents being enslaved, and back to that sort of association for the study of Negro history, which it was called at the time. And then they instituting this Black History Week in February, based on what Truman talked about earlier, the signing of the 13th Amendment.
All right, any other thoughts? People want to contribute their thoughts about Black History Month? And if not,
I just wanted to say I wish I had thought about this ending with Black History Month, and that I would have read Bell Hooks' Ain't I a Woman, who was a very strong activist in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and is sort of tied in for me with the women's perspective on this kind of history and the great poetry in our in all our struggles. And if you have 30 seconds at the end of the show, I'll read my Bridget poem.
Well, let's definitely get to that, but I would like to jump in and talk about when I went to biography.com. There's a tremendous website for a lot of historical Black figures. And I was really intrigued by Marshall Major Taylor, known as mainly as Major Taylor, who ended up in the late 1800s as a poor family. His father ended up being working for a wealthy white family. And so Major Taylor was benefited by some of that privilege by, in one sense, in owning a bicycle. And at the time, in that time of U.S. history, bicycle craze was going absolutely through the roof. And it turns out that despite all of the opposition, when Major Taylor got on the bicycling scene, he was very capable, and many people didn't want him to compete. But he overcame those events. He actually became the second person, I believe, to have a record for the mile. Lots of interesting places to look. Lynn, if we have a moment, please, your poem. All right.
This is an invocation to Bridget at Imbolc. We welcome you, Bridget, on Candlemas Eve. We pray for your blessing, new life to receive. O Mother of Poetry, teach us your art, that your inspiration may enter each heart. O Mistress of Magic that stands by the fire and shapes the bright metal to the form you desire. O Mother of Smithcraft, please teach us your art, that the power of changing may enter each heart. You kindle the springtime to quicken the earth. From under your mantle, the old has new birth. O Mother of Healing, please teach us your art, that peace and contentment may enter each heart.
Lovely.
See you all next week.
Thank you, Lynn. See you, everybody.